Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Cyber Security Recruiter Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Andy Cottrell. How are you doing, my friend?
Doing very well. How are you?
I'm good. You know what? I'm actually going to be a little bit rusty today because we've released an episode every week for as long as I can remember, but we've been about 12 episodes ahead. So this is like the first recording I've done forever, Andy, but I'm going to try my best.
Cool. Trying to remember where all the buttons are.
Exactly. But yeah, nice to see you. For everyone listening, me and Andy were chatting about economics or the economy in general, but we're feeling mildly positive about things, mate, aren't we?
Yeah, particularly in cybersecurity, we're seeing a bit of a bounce from the end of last year with people deciding that 2025 is the year they're going to catch up, because a lot of people dialed back on spending and projects and stuff in 2024. So I think the economy is looking a little better for 25, and also people are coming to the realization that this stuff just can't wait and they've got to get moving. So we're seeing a bit of an uptick at the moment.
Yeah, definitely. And for people listening, we're recording this at the end of January. If you're on the jobs market and you've had a tough time, or maybe you're new into cybersecurity and you've been in the game or been trying to break in for maybe 12, 18 months, something like that. If that is you and you are listening, just hang on in there, because if you've been on the market for the last year or so, especially the junior end or the middle or the mid to lower end, you've probably had a really rough ride. So I don't think that's a normal market at all. And what Andy's just said there is what a lot of my other clients are saying. People are starting to feel positive and get a spring in their step. Yeah, I think there's every reason to be in a good mood, Andy, hey?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've got clients with open positions who are trying to fill them, and some of them are having a little bit of difficulty. So I don't know if the candidates have backed off and got depressed for a little while or something, but it's definitely time to get back and get that resume moving. There are opportunities.
Yeah, no, fully agree. And I think as well on that note, before we get into things, for anyone on the candidate, if you can combine technical skills with the communication skills, with the ability to articulate risk in a clear and concise manner, and you can get yourself out there, and you've got not a massive one, but you've got any form of online presence, I like to call it, making your resume 3D. If you've got any of these things or you're working towards these things, you'll either be hot property pretty soon or you'll already be hot property again. So yeah, no, I think security in general as well. But yeah, Andy, for the listeners that don't know you, started off life as a software engineer for many years, and you quickly progressed up to head of an engineering position. You then progressed on to a senior director posting for around 8 years at Phoenix Technologies. You then went up to C-suite. You were a CTO at Tricipher. You were then a board member and chief scientist for the Security Consortium. You've held a position of the board member, the University of Birmingham, and also the e-risk industry safety community. And also, forgive me if I get this wrong, XOIS?
XOIS, yep.
Yeah, as a technical advisory board member and Mission Chamber Orchestra of San Jose, and their positions you hold currently. And you are also the CTO of Trivantis Inc., and that is a organization that you've now ran for the best part of 15 years. So hell of a career, my friend, and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Yeah, CEO at Trivantis for 15 years. It's been a journey.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, no, it's good. It's nice to have you on the show. I know we're going to talk about a few things, kind of pen testing and red teaming, which I'll love to get into, because I love talking about security, but I love talking about offensive security and in general and a few other things. But I'll start where I always start, Andy, which is, I know I've done you a bit of an intro, but just for the listeners, who are you? What do you get up to? And what's a day in the life like for you right now, my friend?
Sure. So I'm an engineer at heart. I like designing and building stuff, creating things that solve problems, whether that be writing firmware or software or designing and building a company. To me, it's largely the same kind of exercise. You've got a problem domain and you're trying to build the solution that's going to fit. So although I've moved up into management and leadership and trying to run my own organization, to me, it's all still just engineering. You're just trying to build a solution to get a problem solved.
Cool. I bet having that background and starting your own company, in terms of getting the respect of the engineers or the pen testers, or I bet it's a lot easier, because I know from being a recruiter, when your leader gets what you do, it's nice.
Yeah. They've said that a few times, particularly our director of technical services, William. He's an absolute genius. He runs all our technical pen testing and so forth. And he just says he loves having a CEO that he can talk to who understands what he's saying. And understands that the things he's doing are necessary and normal and not scary. But we've also got a very smart general counsel who's deep in the weeds and does a lot of consulting work within privacy and technology for us. And he gets it too. So I think William's kind of found his little utopia that he has executive leadership and legal who understand what he does and have got his back to get the job done.
Yeah, no, it's really cool. And I know it to be true firsthand because as a recruiter, when I'm speaking to people that are passively looking for new stuff, it's one of the gripes that they have is that a new leader has been maybe drafted in and that he or she just doesn't grasp what they do and it causes friction. I'm working on another director of pen testing role, actually, for another company at the minute. One of the hard requirements is they have to still be really strong technically. For this exact reason, because people appreciate it.
Yeah, and it's not just the technical side. I think the legal side is important as well, particularly on pen testing, because you're up towards the edge of what's allowed and what's not allowed. You've got to be very careful of that boundary. And the pen testers are often saying, you know, this is what I've been hired to do. And then the legal department is like, you can't do that. That's dangerous and scary. But it's the job. And then the other way around, you also need an organization that understands how dangerous this stuff can be. I mean, pen testers have ended up in jail because the paperwork and the organization and the communication wasn't right and so forth. So we both got to support them in doing their job because it's clearly legal adjacent, right? You've got to make sure that you stay on the right side of the law. And you've got all the authorizations, but also make sure that we're not putting people at risk and we've got them fully prepared and backed.
Yeah, I'm sure you've got some stories and I've heard all sorts of stories, especially on physical engagements. I've heard all kinds of crazy stuff going down.
And then you get into the really interesting stuff is we had one once where we went through and we followed all our procedures and then we found this really interesting vulnerability and we started exploring it, poking through. Compromised the system and we were running away. And then we found out that that wasn't even a client system. They gave us the wrong IP address. Mm. They gave us the IP address of something they don't own. And then suddenly, right, all the lawyers' phones are ringing and we're trying to sort stuff out. So it's, you've got to plan to do it right, but you've also got to be ready for when somebody else gets something wrong and drops you in hot water, right? These are dangerous scenarios.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks to that client for giving you the wrong IP. That wasn't very good.
I mean, we make them fill out a form and sign in blood to say that they own these things. And yet they managed to give us the wrong one anyway.
Well, cool. All right, let's dive into it. And I know we were talking about just before we hit record here, we were talking about the difference between pen testing and red teaming and how it can frustrate you for different reasons. You can actually relate it to job adverts quite a lot because the amount of times you'll see a red teaming advert and you're like, no, that's a web app pen testing. Anyway, we can probably talk about that alone for hours. But yeah, give me your thoughts.
Because these terms are used a lot, especially in standards. And yet they're often ill-defined. And where they are widely used, it's often marketing that has decided what it means. Mm-hmm. And then, that's a problem. When I first started looking into this, I decided NIST, right? US company, we'll go to NIST and I'll look up the NIST definitions of pen tested. And I found four or five different definitions in different standards. And they were contradictory. They couldn't all be true. Okay, so it's a difficult area to actually draw the line as to exactly what it is. And then you get people who are mis-selling things. So somebody will buy a pen test and they'll get given a vulnerability assessment report that says pen test on the cover. And you look through it and you think, well, what did these guys do? They ran a vulnerability scanner and then wrote up a report. There's nothing there. They didn't do anything. So the first threshold for us is that for it to be a pen test, it's got to involve operator cunning. Right. That is the essential part is that you've got a cunning expert who is trying to do insightful things that you can't get out of an automated tool. So that's kind of the threshold for it being penetration testing. But the other problem we see is the conflation of pen testing and red team exercises. I've been told by a leader at a reasonably large pen test consulting firm, the red team exercise is a pen test with almost no rules, right? Break no glass, break no bones. Beyond that, it's all fair game in a red team exercise. But if you constrain us, then it's a pen test. Someone else told me that a red team exercise is a pen test that includes social engineering. So it's all very vague and fluffy and everyone has their own definition. Yeah. So what we've said is penetration testing is using these adversarial techniques to see, can you break in? And if you can break in, how bad would it be? How far can you get, right?
Yeah.
And then a red team exercise is, if I tried to break in, would you detect me? Would you catch me? So the red team exercise is testing detection and response mechanisms, whereas the pen test is testing your defense mechanisms.
Yeah, I think as well, like when it'd be nice to get some insights from you from the client side, from the sorts of calls you get at Trivantis, Andy. But I would imagine a lot of clients, when they ring up and go, I want a red team, is first of all, that's an expensive engagement. And you've got to have a hell of a security posture in the first place for that to be even viable. Or the game's going to be up pretty quickly, isn't it?
So, I mean, you can size to fit and you can pick your focus.
Okay.
We've managed to make them small and focused and affordable. And I think they are.
Okay.
We've kind of changed our thinking over the last couple of years. We used to think in kind of this evolution of maturity, you know, get your vulnerability management under control. When you've done that, move on to pen testing. As you grow and you become more mature, move on to red teaming. I don't think that way anymore. I think if you're buying pen testing, you should be buying red teaming. And there's a very specific reason for that. We say, when we talk about the evolving threat landscape and how things are changing, there's this kind of new-ish mantra that you hear all the time of, the bad guys are inside your perimeter. They are in now. They've been in before. They will be in again. You need to adapt your security program to understand that they're in. So forget this hard perimeter model of keeping them out. They are in. So, okay, how do we evolve our security program in order to respond to that knowledge? And it's really quite funny to see people will go to all these conferences to get their CPEs and so forth, and they'll sit there and they'll soak this in and go, yeah, they're on the inside. That's really important point. I've learned something today. Then they go back to their regular job and they don't change anything based on this new knowledge. But my argument is, if you're going to recognize that they're inside and they're going to be inside again, detection becomes hugely much more important. So pen testing, can they get in? Red team, will you find them when they're in? I think it needs to be elevated in priority these days. And you need to have a budget and then split it between pen testing and red teaming, because you've got to test both mechanisms.
Yeah. I suppose a lot of it as well will depend on the client. I'm imagining you get some fairly sophisticated clients, and then I'm imagining you get some that they need some help and need educating, I'm imagining.
Yeah, more of the latter, interestingly. The state of the art is pretty variable. Organizations, I mean, it's obviously large budgets, right? A lot of this is just down to budget, and particularly headcount, which is a part of budget. People are just, they don't have the bandwidth. So you've got to automate. And I talked to clients about in the US, we have this cybersecurity framework from NIST, which is pushed by, promoted by the US government for everybody. And it has these pillars. It used to be 5 pillars. They've added a 6th, which is governance, which is great. But it's identify what you've got, protect it, detect when they're there, respond to it, and then recover after the attack, right? So it's all these things. You've got to move your automation to the left, right? Get your tools doing all this inventorying, understanding, reviewing, protecting, automate your hardening, automate your vulnerability assessments. Try and get as much of that achieved for as little as possible on the budget, and move your skills to the right, where people are actually watching, evaluating, detecting, responding, recovering. That's where you need to put your human effort and put more effort into governance, so that you know what you're doing and you know if you're meeting your objectives and achieving your plan.
Yeah, cool. Do you know what? It's nice that you're talking about segregating it off to different parts and saving certain bits for the humans and automating this and automating hardening. Because from listening to you there, it sounds to me like, in a way, I think from the pen tester's perspective, automation, I think it's actually, in a way, saving the really technical, stimulating, fun parts for the human. So I don't think there's anything to fear there. It sounds like if you can get it right, like you've described, it sounds like A, it could be a better service, and B, probably you're saving the fun parts for the actual tester.
Absolutely. And the same goes for getting people to invest in vulnerability and patch management before they invest too much in pen testing. Right? Hiring a pen tester to tell you that you've got weak ciphers on your SSH ports, a vulnerability scanner could have done that, right? And yet we find this stuff all the time, missing patches, default passwords and things. Got to rely on automation and vulnerability scanning to find this stuff. Use tools to maintain and manage it, and automate your identity management stuff so that it just reaches out and keeps stuff in order. Automate your system hardening. have an SDLC process and a DevOps process so that your stuff is always hardened to a standard. Build all that, invest in that at a structural level so that when the pen tester comes in, he runs his initial reconnaissance to see what's there and to listen to the network and to run some vulnerability scans and do some Nmaps and stuff. And he should be able to look at those results and say, okay, I've got nothing. So now I'm going to need to actually start working today and doing some really cool stuff rather than, okay, there's a missing patch there. It's a known vulnerability. There's an exploit in a library there. I'm just going to run the exploit like I always do and I'll break in and then I'll get admin and it'll be easy, right? Your vulnerability management program should prevent that. And your pen testers should actually have to earn their living.
Yeah, definitely. I was actually watching a YouTube video at the weekend. I don't know if you've seen this one, Andy. It was some hackers stole, I think it was 100 million or a billion out of a load of cash points from a Russian. And it was just, again, it was just a known exploit in Windows, just not updated. That's all it was. You know, the amount of times we hear that.
Yeah, absolutely. But one of the things is, you know that that's bad, right? It's known exploits, missing patches, you know. So you've got to do the right thing. You've got to do your basic security hygiene all the time, everywhere. And then your pen testers are going to find things which aren't basic vulnerabilities, or they're going to find things that you didn't realize were there. They're going to find holes in your understanding, gaps in your inventory. We broke in once to an organization through, I think it was a Windows XP server or something a couple of years ago. So it shouldn't have even been in existence. And the reason that it was there and unpatched was because it was a VM that some previous IT guy had set up years ago and they had powered it off. But during a power outage of the host, it came auto-ran and so it just popped back up again. Those are the kind of things where I don't mind that it was the pen test that found it. Although really vulnerability management should be mapping out all your IP addresses. But that kind of, you had a good process, but you found a gap in the process. But what people need to do is move beyond what we call vulnerability whack-a-mole, right? So you do a test, you get some results, you fix all those things, and then you come back in a month for a VM or maybe 6 months or a year for a pen test. You do it again, you get some more findings, you fix those things. You need to move beyond that. And when you get a pen test report, you need to almost open two tickets per finding. One is to go and fix the issue. The other is to see how you can improve your process so that that kind of issue either can't happen structurally or would automatically get caught and detected and addressed. Shouldn't be relying on the pen test to find the same issue or similar issues year over year. So I always like it when people go through the pen test reports with a fine tooth comb and not just fix the findings, but fix their governance process, their security program, or not fix it, enhance it to say, okay, found a scenario that wasn't addressed. Let's go and fix that structurally from side to side. And then the other thing is, if it's a good pen test report, it will be long. I mean, we do pen test reports that are sometimes hundreds of pages, but we write that stuff for a reason. And a lot of it tried this, didn't work. We tried this, didn't work. We tried this, didn't work, right? We're giving you the narrative of everything that we did. The reason we write all that down is so that you can see what the pen tester's doing, which simulates what an attacker would be doing. And then you can go through a report and say, okay, it didn't work, but if that was tried by a real adversary, would I have detected it? Would I know that that's in place? Okay, it didn't work there, but am I confident it wouldn't work everywhere in my environment, right? So you really should spend a lot of time getting value out of the pen test report and reading that narrative and reviewing your controls against the activities of the pen tester rather than just saying, okay, there were 5 high severity findings. I'm going to go fix those and then we'll come back next year and do it all again.
Yeah. What do you think it is, Eddie? Do you think some like IT guys or girls, they almost get a bit sensitive when you find stuff, or do you think it's a time issue or a bit of both, or depends on the person?
So the sensitivity issue is very interesting and it varies wildly depending on the culture of the organization.
Okay.
We quite often actually end up with clients trying to negotiate wording in the pen test report due to political issues internally. And sometimes it's they don't want it to look so bad. And sometimes they want it to look worse because they're trying to get budget secured and they just want it to look really scary and things like this. So people are always trying to negotiate with us about the positioning and the messaging to suit their internal politics. But I think that obviously the really good houses, they're eager right? Tell me everything. We think we're doing a really good job. We think we're locked down. If you can find a gap, I want to know about it. Better you than the attacker. Let's find it and fix it. So a good house is eager to get the information.
Yeah, cool. Do you think Andy, it's always, because you must notice a big difference between, it's a shame, but a lot of it is if an organization's been hit before or not, isn't it? Like if they've been hit before, they really step up, don't they? But it's unfortunate, but.
Frustrates me so much that we see organizations who have an incident and then suddenly from somewhere they find millions of dollars to reboot the cybersecurity program. It's not a binary game, right? It's not do the program right and don't get breached, or do it wrong and you will get breached. It's not that simple. We talk in terms of risk, but risk is like going to Vegas and gambling, right? It's, are you going to win? Are you going to lose? Well, there's a chance it could be either way. And you don't want to reduce your risk to zero. If you reduce your risk to zero, fine. So now you've got no computers, no employees, no clients, right? That's how you get to zero risk. You go into business to take risk, right? Nothing ventured, nothing gained. People are putting capital at risk when they start companies. They want risk. So really, cybersecurity is about optimizing risk. So the ideal situation is to say to a company, you need to build your cybersecurity program so that if you were breached, you would change nothing as a result. Because that was just the way the math worked out, the way the dice rolled, but you had the right program to reduce the risk of that happening down to a small enough chance that it's not going to happen very often. And then you need to focus on response and recovery and business continuity. You need to make sure that so that if you do have something which is technically a breach or an incident, then it's not business impacting. It's not client impacting, those kind of things. So it's all an exercise in reducing risk, but you need to make sure people really understand what risk is. Risk is just another word for statistics. You're reducing the probability. So in 100 years, there's going to be a year of a 1% chance thing happening, right? That's what risk is.
Yeah, cool. I think business continuity is a massive one. If you get breached, that's one thing and it's bad. But if you're out of action for a number of days, weeks or months, then that's a different ballgame, isn't it?
It is. And it's frustrating that people will suddenly find these response, not so much the incident response budgets, but the recovery and rebuild budget. Let's spend an extra $2 million really improving our cyber program. Well, why didn't you do that first? If you had the risk in the wrong place, why didn't you move it before the breach rather than waiting until after?
Cool. So, yeah, so on the, we were talking before, Andy, about when people see, were you meaning when they see attacks in the wild? They see attacks in the wild and they don't change off the back of that. Is that what you were alluding to before?
It's not even so much attacks in the wild. It's more doing grown-up cybersecurity, and it's complicated, but it's not unknown, right? We know how to build a robust cybersecurity program with the governance cycle and risk assessments and business continuity plans, disaster recovery plans, hardening, pen testing, vulnerability. We know how all of these pieces, what they are and how they work together. People don't do them. They do them, when they do them, they often do it for compliance. So when we get an inbound lead, we say to people, okay, you've come here, you're buying, we were talking pen testing, you're asking for a pen test. Okay, firstly, what is it that you need to make sure that they're using the word the same way we do? And then we ask, why do you want this? What's the driver? And most times, sadly, they say, it's compliance, just need to check the box. I've got an obligation to do a pen test. I don't want to spend any money. I want it done quick without disturbing the rest of our operations. Just need to check the box. That's the wrong approach. You got to worry about the risk to the organization. Cybersecurity and privacy are about managing business risk, and everything needs to train back up to that.
Yeah, I suppose when you get a client that is just ticking a box or whatever, to then get them to look at the report and look at the processes associated with that vulnerability and stuff like that, I can imagine that's tricky at that point.
It is tricky. We try to write these executive summaries in the report, which are digestible by leadership. And in there, we often say scary things about in summary of the environment that we found and the lack of diligence necessary, if necessary, because it's just so common that people are not doing it right. And doing it right is well known. It just requires budget and it just requires a commitment. And the commit, I mean, commitment is expensive as well, right? It means you're going to be working on that instead of the other thing, which is often business enablement, right? And this is why it's frustrating in life just to see the head of security, which might be the chief information security officer or whoever, reporting into an enablement function like IT or R&D. So now you've got a guy who is in charge of both getting stuff out of the door and managing the risk associated with getting stuff out the door. So you got this guy who's fighting these dual priorities. Okay, which one is in his bonus plan? This one or the getting features out the door plan, right? It's a conflict there. It's why it's always great when security and risk management gets up to the leadership team and the board through a different channel. It goes around IT and R&D. We often see it reporting up through legal, and that's great. Because lawyers are great at just having conversations about what's the risk. That's what they do. They're basically chief risk officers. We've seen it report up through finance, then it becomes a bit budget focused. But I love it when it reports up through legal.
Yeah, yeah. It's an interesting point that you make about when people in leadership positions are getting pulled in both ways. And I've seen it more and more lately where the CISO and the CIO position is getting merged into one and things are changing there. And yeah, it's an interesting conversation, and it must be tricky for them.
It must be tricky. But like I say, all the pressure for OKRs and MBOs and all those kind of things is going to be on the enablement and delivery side. Nobody's going to get an MBO which says optimize our risk profile.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, all right, Andy. You mentioned that when we first came on, you were talking about this couple of like mega individuals in the organization. It'd be nice to hear like from you as a business owner and leader, what makes people on your team great? What do you look for when you're looking for different people? Like, what's real standout things that could help the listeners in terms of elevating their career growth and career progression?
So two things, really. One is definitely being a team player, and that's easy to say, but people sometimes have a tendency to say, this is my world, this is my job, I'm just going to do my thing here and I'll get on with it. We want people who interface more widely, but also aren't afraid to say, I don't know that, or I might not be the right guy for that, or I'm going to go and have to learn that for you, or is there someone that can help you with this? Or they start a project and then say, you know what, I'm out of my depth here, I need the team to help lift me up. That's what teams are for. Right? Nobody gets in trouble here for saying that they don't know something, right? You get bonus points for it, right? Because we're all learning all the time. So people who don't have that kind of ego of both, this is mine, leave me alone, and also I succeed or fail on my own merit. It's like, no, you succeed or fail by making the team stronger. And the other is on the actual performance side, we need people that look at the bigger picture, right? So yes, you've got a task. What is that task and why is it important? How does what you're doing fit into everything else? So if we were hiring for perhaps a more junior position, a security analyst or something who's going to be looking at a lot of details and data and is this machine hardened or looking at these logs and those kind of things, that's great. That's important. There are very important skills that person needs to have for doing that job. But they need to understand risk and they need to understand what a security program looks like and what is their part in it. And we're not looking for success or failure in the piece we gave them. We're looking for success or failure in the security program. And they are a piece of that machine. And they need to care about the whole machine and the interfaces between what comes into them and what goes out from them. And is it good data coming in? Are they giving good data going out in order to achieve success for the security program or the business project as a whole? So people who have broader horizons beyond their specific remit.
Cool. Yeah, Andy, thanks, man. That's really cool. So you don't have to know the answer to everything. You've got to be confident enough to say, I don't know, and that's not a negative. You get bonus points. Leave your ego at the door. Really understand the bigger picture, understanding risk, being able to interface and being able to communicate and making sure what you're communicating with end clients and what you're communicating to the team internally is clear and concise. It's nice to hear you, because I think there's a lot of people out there that maybe get a certification or they get this and they get that. And they literally think, that's it, I should get a job. But especially in the consulting world, there's just so much more to it than that, isn't there?
There is. You got to understand the bigger picture of the security program, but you really need to understand the bigger picture of the business that's relying on you. And the same applies actually for pen testing. Pen testing is a very interesting space. And it's funny, it's the cool and sexy one that everyone wants to do, right? When I'm meeting with young people, graduates, whatever, and they want to go to cybersecurity, okay, what role are you looking for? Oh, I want to be a pen tester, right? My attitude is, okay, that's great. Come back in a decade when you understand how technology works. Right? Mm. I need you to be able to build a web stack, understand and be able to drive Kerberos and Kubernetes and all the other Ks. I need you to be able to use all these different tools and be able to use them for the purposes they're intended so that if you understand how they work, you can see how to break them. What I don't want is somebody who's going to say, some other smart guy over there has worked out how to find these vulnerabilities and has given me an exploit that I can use. And I'm just going to turn the wheel of pen testing. Right? I meet people that really understand the environments that they're attacking.
Mm. Yeah. And I think that it's true what you say. You talk to anyone that's trying to break in. It's, I want to be a hacker or I even want to be a SOC analyst. And I don't know if I agree with you. I don't know if stepping in from that realm of never been doing it straight into a hacker, you know, is it even possible? I think you've got to come in through ideally like a sysadmin, IT role, help desk, maybe come in at GRC, something like that, and then eventually work your way up and get that foundational knowledge, apart from maybe the odd one or two that can just, you know, maybe not. But I think you've got to have that proper route through your career.
It's ideal. Having said that, it's often not economically possible as an employer, right? I can't just have only senior people. So we need to build structures so that every pentest has a senior person involved and making sure that anyone who's new in their career is being supervised and supported. But to anyone who's actually trying to build a career in pentesting, I would say spend 50% of your learning on learning pentesting and the other half on learning IT and R&D and write code and build solutions and understand how stuff works, because that's the stuff you're trying to break. You need to know how it works.
Mm. Yeah, cool. Thanks, Abby. That's when you mentioned as well about not needing to know the answer for everything, like for everyone listening, I see that a lot across different companies, and people like people to have the confidence to say they don't know. I've even had it where people will put an interview question in there that is literally impossible to answer because they just want someone to say, I don't know.
Yep.
So, just for everyone listening, like it's okay. The worst thing to do, now I'm imagining being on the call to an end client and you're not knowing the answer and you just pretend you do and make something up. That's the worst case scenario that is being checked for there.
So I went for an interview once myself where there was a question which contained an error. And I've used that technique as well to ask a question which contains an obvious error. And I'm not even looking to find out whether they spot the error because it's so obvious. What I want is for them to pipe up and say, that's actually wrong.
I bet that's quite, what's the ratios? What's the hit rate?
That 50-50.
I do really.
That's a huge skill. And particularly to be able to challenge authority, right? I'm the CEO of the company. I rely on people telling me I'm stupid and wrong, right? Because otherwise everyone just does what I say, and that's just supremely scary.
Yeah, it could be good fun though, mate. And also as well, I think having the confidence to pipe up, and also it's probably quite interesting for you to see the way they approach that situation as well. Is there different ways that people do pipe up? Some are maybe really good at handling it and some maybe aren't. I bet that's quite interesting as well.
It is. I mean, how much tact and diplomacy? And as we're a consulting firm, tact and diplomacy is huge, right? So are they going to look at it and go, well, that question's stupid, right? Okay, that's one approach. Or are they going to say, you know, there's some implications in that question which may not actually be fully true in all scenarios, right? That's another approach. So seeing how they actually phrase it when they do flag it is also very insightful.
Yeah, cool. Right, in terms of on the business itself, for people listening that might want to, how can you tell us about how Trevanti started? What was it like taking the leap from, so you was a software engineer, then you was head of engineering, held a director position. So you were going that way gradually, but what was it like actually taking that?
Surprising. It wasn't actually a plan to start my own company. So I was with TriCypher, I was the CTO there. And after I left there, I was just working out what I wanted to do next. And I ended up doing a bit of consulting, helping some friends out, and then a bit more consulting. Then I got my friend to come and help me with the consulting because there was so much. We kind of rolled backwards into having a company.
Okay, cool. Okay, so so it was quite a transitional phase then, really. You were permanent contracting, consulting, and then it just gathered momentum through doing a good job referral. Yeah.
The early years were definitely built by networking and referrals. Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. But yeah, I think that's something I push that on the pod quite a bit as well. I think like me and you, the likes of me and you working remotely and stuff, I think it's fine. But I think for like people breaking in or people at more of a junior level, if they're just working remotely and they've never maybe networked and stuff like that, I think they're missing out on a big trick. I think it's huge at the start of your career, especially for breaking in. You mentioned talking to graduates at conferences earlier and stuff like that. It's the place where it all happens. And it's the place where the biggest amount of learnings are done as well, I think.
I agree. Yeah. Although conferences, you got to be careful and pick and choose because a lot of them are very vendor driven and you go into the sessions and you're just learning about why, all the reasons that you should give the vendor money, but they will kind of spin the learning in order to feed you into, and the obvious solution is to buy our product, right? So you got to be still careful with some of the conferences. The other place in the US, I don't know elsewhere, but in the US, there's a lot of local chapters for business organizations. So we have the ISSA for people who build security programs and ISACA for the auditors and also the builders and OWASP and lots of other groups that you can go to once a month or something. And the information is often, sometimes it's vendor speak, but it's often very insightful. And you get to meet lots of cool people, often in senior positions in the industry. And that's great from not just career opportunity, but also getting yourself a little part-time mentor who will coach you through stuff and help you think through next steps and things. So I'm a big advocate of these industry groups that you could join, particularly if you're earlier in your career. Just go out and make friends and learn something.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's massive. And I think it's a part that almost has to be spoken about these days because it's so easy just to sit behind a screen and it's one of the reasons why I wanted to start the podcast, Andy, because it's like my travel time, my commute time is pretty much non-existent these days. Why can't I take an hour out of my week, even every week, and just do this and have a nice chat, because we're so much more efficient these days. You mentioned there about vendor speak and careful going to conferences and stuff like that. Do you see that a lot where clients are just basically just over tech, like it's just too much security tech and it's causing problems?
A little bit. We see people getting their priorities wrong. So I saw a client once where we were going in, they were quite green and didn't really have a plan, but they had bought some tools. And one of the tools was one of these packet inspection tools. And he was very proud of the fact that you go to a console and review every packet that had flowed through the organization and tell me what was going where and see all the DNS queries and understand all the connection. I thought, that's great, but you don't have a vulnerability management practice. Program and all your servers are unpatched, right? Could you take that budget and put it there first? And we'll come back to that one later. It's not that it was a bad tool. It was just that was the sales guy that got him at the right time. And that's the other thing, is that people go out and they learn all this academic stuff and they get their qualifications and they know how to run a grown-up security program, but they don't have time. And so what happens? The phone rings, it's a vendor, they get a story. Oh yeah, this will solve all your problems. Just get this one tool. It's going to fix everything. And it's just so easy to just, okay, I really don't have the program the way I'd like it, but at least I have this tool and that's going to save me. And so people have over-reliance on tools because they don't have time to do the job, the governance job properly, and actually go through and work out where the risks are. But I'm really more worried about vendors bending language and tricking people through misrepresentation. Even if it's somewhat innocent, though it often isn't, would be attack surface, right? So we talk a lot now about what is your attack surface. So you get these tools that have attack surface management features. Great. So you've learned you need to manage your attack surface. You've now got a tool that says attack surface management, got it under control. But it's only under control with regard to the stuff that tool can see. Other pieces of your attack surface, your facility, your staff, the people using their mobile phones to check their email, right? Well, there's lots of attack surface. Just because you bought a tool that had a feature labeled attack surface doesn't mean it's job done on understanding and inventorying your attack surface. It's a useful tool. It's a good tool. You should have it. But don't let the label trick you into thinking you've done the job.
In the East and the attack, obviously going back years ago to now, the attack surface is just huge, isn't it? You're talking about mobile device. It's just massive, isn't it? Massive.
It is. And it change over time, right? So we had the whole perimeter argument, right? It's no longer a hard perimeter and you need to worry about the security of the stuff on the inside. And then there was the cloud, but we work our way through and there was zero trust. And now it's AI, right? It's the flavor of the day. But it's funny because each of these things, as they arrive, they kind of change everything. But they also change nothing. It's still a cybersecurity program. There are five pillars. You need to do your inventory. You need to protect all the stuff. You need to understand your attack surface, right? So in some ways, they change everything. And in some ways, they change nothing.
Yeah, I mean, AI, I mean, it's almost a bit cliche to bring it, but it's everywhere. I don't know if you went to Vegas last year, but I just heard the minute you got off the plane for kind of a DEF CON and Black Hat, it was just like literally, I think the first sign someone said they saw was like this big AI sign, and that was just the theme for the whole weekend. It's just everywhere. But what is it helping you personally in the business? Are you getting some good gains off it? What are you seeing out there?
It's a very interesting space, and we see a lot of people being very reckless and failing to pick up their governance program and stretch it out over AI because there are so many different facets of it that affect a business. We use it internally for some things. Mm. So it's stuff to do with marketing things that helps us speed up there, definitely. We've actually mostly banned AI in all tools because we started doing a bit of due diligence and checking where the data was going and what assurances we were getting from the vendors. And it, either they wouldn't tell us or what they told us was scary about where the data goes. So we had to ban it because we don't want client data going up into some random tool that one of our vendors is using to transcribe from audio to text or whatever. And we don't know. It's an outfitter in Russia and they're, who knows?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Go through and do kind of full supply chain due diligence there. So we basically just banned everything. And I think the due diligence piece would be so big for us. We are probably going to move to an on-prem model instead, or not on-prem, but roll our own and build tools internally to give us that kind of business advantage that we can see is there. We can see it. Mm. We can taste it. Mm. But we don't currently have a safe way of using it until we get the time to build our own out in AWS or something where we can comply with the commitments we've made to our clients about protecting their data.
Yeah, that's massive, that is, because this data with all these, it is just going. It's definitely just, like you said, you've banned it for a reason. It's going everywhere.
We looked at one of the security statements from a vendor, and I can't remember which, but we were looking at the Microsoft AI and Zoom and Box and everybody else, all the tools that we use. But one of them we looked at, it said, we may share anything that you give us through this AI tool with unnamed, unmanaged third-party service providers to assist us with the task. And there was nothing in there about how they were protecting or controlling it. And that was the point where we said, we don't have time for this. Right. We have information, but our client data is not going into any AI until we build our own internally. And the days of being able to build your own internally are pretty much here, right? So it's not that hard.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think whenever it's being used, you've got to have a massive understanding of what you're doing still, haven't you? You can't just rely on it. Even as something as simplistic on the recruitment side as like a lead gen tool. We've had people on the team here use them and they don't check it and they just go and it hasn't done what it said it was going to do. And I can imagine the same happening for a pen testing tool with AI. If you don't know what you're doing, it can make you look very silly.
Right. I mean, the thing with AI is you've got to think of your AI as an incredibly industrious team of interns, right? They're going to get a lot done, but they're interns, right? Check everything, give clear instructions, don't believe or trust anything, right? So they're a great tool. I'm a big advocate for AI. And personally, outside of work, I use it all the time. It's huge. Mm. But not trusting it with client data anytime soon.
Yeah, no, you're right. I think if it's used properly, I think it's one of those. We'd all be crazy to go full hog and go too far too quickly. But at the same time, we'd be crazy to ignore it. So it's probably taking a balanced approach. But I think there's definitely a big opportunity to do more with less and stuff like that. And I've seen various different companies where that is definitely happening. And talk about in-house capabilities. Yeah, I'm seeing that as well across various companies where they're building out various different products in-house and having a lot of fun in the process as well. But yeah,
so
I think
it's great to address that kind of data governance problem, but now you're taking on all the risks associated with building out of these components. And that's a new space that we're only just beginning to understand, is where the risks are with AI and R&D. And OWASP has done some great work with their top 10 for LLMs and stuff, but that's just one piece. So we AI risk governance a lot, and there's different domains of risk that an organization is exposed to. So there's certainly risks associated with building your own AI to use internally, sure. There's risk associated with the vendors that you choose to use, where you build it into your business processes, okay? There's also the risks associated with the attackers that are using AI. So the whole way that you're getting attacked is now different. Flip side to that is the vendors you're relying on to defend you are starting to use AI as well. So that balances out somewhat. If history is anything to go by, the attackers will get the net advantage out of that. And then there's what I call shadow AI and stealth AI, right? So shadow AI, like shadow IT, you said no, but they're using it anyway because they know better about what's good for the company, and they work faster if they use it. So that's shadow AI. And then there's stealth AI, which is where you didn't want it, you didn't ask for it, you didn't approve it, but the vendor of a tool just pushed it out to all your users anyway.
Yeah, someone told me that pretty much in any photo, there's like some form, like even on an iPhone photo, there's like some form of AI kind of blended in now. It's just everywhere.
You've been using AI for years. And AI, you remember, is more than just the LLMs piece where you're having a conversation and chatbots and stuff. AI has been around for decades. So if you've ever traced out a number with your finger on your phone and it's worked out what that is, that's an AI. There's a mathematical model behind that that was trained, probably a little baby neural network that was trained to work out how to turn finger swipes into characters on a keyboard. Using AI for years, what's changed recently is the explosive availability of it and reduced cost. And the ecosystem of tools that are now available to stitch things together really easily to make stuff happen. So that's what's changed recently. But AI's been around for decades.
Yeah, it's going to be the next kind of 2 to 5 years is going to be fascinating. And you talk about governance and stuff like that. The rate that we're seeing change at now is just so quick. Governing bodies and governance and governments around the world struggle to keep up at the best of times. I think they're going to struggle more and more.
They are. And what you need to do is build your governance program so it's kind of resistant to change. So used to be you'd look at somebody's security policy and it would say things like passwords need to be at least 8 characters and mixed numbers and letters and stuff. This day and age, that's not what should be in policy. Policy should be about how you manage risk in authentication scenarios, how you classify data and so forth. And then those details, those need to be out in day-to-day operational standards. You need to build policy that's kind of much higher level and will resist the seas of change, because it's still data and it's still a tool and you're still sharing it with a third party. Therefore, we already wrote that policy. Let's go and apply it to this new AI vendor and work out what that's going to make us do over there.
Cool. Yeah. It's going to be certainly interesting times. I'm going to, as I come to the end here, I always like to find out, I used to always ask people about the different books they've read and stuff like that, but it can be books or content you're consuming or podcasts. But I always like to ask, what book have you read or pod or anything? It could be security related. It could just be like self-development, just anything you've consumed that's been really helpful for your own career growth or self-development that could help the listeners.
So I do not read much of that myself lately. Now I tend to have AIs read it for me and summarize it.
Okay, cool.
And I get them to collate and merge multiple sources. So, okay, I'm interested in this topic. Go out and find me a bunch of information. And then I go through it. If there's anything I think is interesting, click back on the links, go back, read the original paragraph. But because of that, you're reading all sorts of stuff.
Wow.
And I also use a feed reader, which goes out and looks at 50 different sources for information. And so, again, I'm picking stuff out on an article by article basis rather than getting stuck with one author, one book, one thing like that. So I try to surf the entire spectrum of what's available there for me to learn from.
Yeah, cool. I like that answer. It's a different answer, but I like it. What tool do you use?
So I use Feedly for the getting the wet feeds and organizing that. And then I go back and forth at the moment between ChatGPT and Perplet4, the chat-based interfaces. But there are many or more out there, and I tinker with many others from time to time, but those are my two core. I pay for both of those. Everyone else, I just toe in the water.
Okay. Yeah, okay. So I saw something on LinkedIn earlier that was talking about the code base for, I think, Claude. That's maybe good, I think, Claude AI.
I think Claude is. I think I haven't done it yet, but I think I can point Perplexity to use Claude.
Okay.
But I find the ChatGPT is a little bit more, this is just my experience, I find it a bit more creative. It's also a better coder, because I do use them to write code. And Perplexity is a little bit more disciplined, a bit more organized, a bit more structural, better at attributing information as to where it got it from. So it depends what I'm doing. And sometimes I'll use both. And if I'm writing up a piece, I'll write an outline of what I want to say. I'll give it to one of them, say, expand this out to 500 words, take that, edit it a bit, and then give it to the other one and say, improve this for style and tone, to edit that, and then give it back. And I just go back and forth, and they can both play with it until it's in the state that I'm happy with.
Yeah. Just listening to you there, it's amazing. I feel quite far behind with that, because I need to really get with it and have a play around with these things. I'm still sat here after every call, Andy, writing notes on pen and paper.
Yeah, you just need to remember it is a tool. It is not a replacement, right? So yeah. I'm still writing the article that I'm writing, the tool to help me go faster and maybe get a bit broader research. But at the end of the day, that article's mine and in me, and it says what I want it to say. These tools are just helping me go a bit faster.
Yeah. No, it sounds good. No, it sounds good, my friend. But yeah, exciting year ahead planned, feeling optimistic.
We are. Yeah. Big growth year for us. And also, I think a good transformative year for a lot of our clients, finally getting time and budget to work on the programs they've been aspiring to. So should be good.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I think it's like we said, ever since COVID, like the world just seems really crazy, like all over the world. Like it's, obviously, COVID was just the economy just went boom and then it kicked back the other way. I feel like we're still almost recovering from that. But yeah, Andy, an hour soon goes quick. So we'll wrap it up here. But I know you're a busy man, so I'll let you shoot. And thanks, mate. It's been really nice to sit down and have a good old chit chat.
Great. Enjoyed chatting with you. Talk to you again soon.
Thanks.